This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Tuesday, the surveillance state. Which Australian city has more CCTV cameras than Moscow, and why?
Public space, private space, on public transport. Some of the systems are deliberately designed to be visible. Others are deliberately concealed so that you can't tell that they're there. So it could be just about anywhere.
And as climate change kicks in, warnings of giant waves swamping our coastlines. But first today, the Prime Minister is stoking the debate about China's influence in our region, saying Australia is heading into a difficult period managing its relationships with the world's major powers. Scott Morrison said he doesn't see signs of the trade war between China and the US ending anytime soon, and he says we need to get used to this level of tension. Here's political reporter Stephanie Boris.
As the Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison has a number of things on his mind at any one time, but what is it that keeps him up at night?
This is going to be one of the most difficult periods in which to manage our relationships with some of the biggest powers in the world.
There has been a renewed discussion about how Australia should handle its relationship with China after Liberal MP Andrew Hastie warned our freedoms could be diminished if the government underestimated Beijing's influence. Mr. Hastie, who chairs the Parliamentary Joint Committee for Intelligence and Security, faced criticism from some for writing the opinion piece, but he's standing by his comments.
My op-ed stands and I don't resile from it. We've got a great democracy. That's what democracies do, we debate, and so I welcome the contest of ideas.
Speaking on Channel 7, Scott Morrison says Australia has built strong ties with China, both on a friendship level and economically.
Equally, we've got to be very clear that as a country, we welcome China's growth. I mean, why would we want to contain China's growth? I mean, that'd be a bit of a numpier thing to do, I would have thought. And so we welcome that.
But he's insisted that as China grows, it needs to play by the same rules as other nations.
Having achieved that critical mass of economic performance, the rules that apply to all of us, the United States, got to apply in China as well. And the rules-based order, where it comes to how technology is handled, how partnerships are formed, how payments are made, how the rules apply, how you reduce emissions, for example. I mean, we should all be subject to the same rules now.
Peter Jennings is the Executive Director at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
It is a significant comment, and really what it highlights, of course, is that China is not playing by the same rules right now. China is, you know, a number one strategic problem for Australia in terms of its intelligence gathering, its use of cyber means to steal intellectual property.
When it comes to conflicting views on rules, the number one issue is the trade war between the United States and China. US President Donald Trump is keeping the door open to a resolution.
I think President Xi, who's somebody I like a lot, I think he wants to make a deal. But frankly, he's not going fast enough.
But there have been a number of hurdles along the way, the most recent protests in Hong Kong. President Trump has urged China to be careful, and Vice President Mike Pence recently stated that the US wants the issue resolved before trade talks can proceed.
We're in the midst of productive discussions with China, and they'll continue in the weeks ahead. But for the United States to make a deal with China, Beijing needs to honor its commitments, beginning with the commitment China made in 1984 to respect the integrity of Hong Kong's laws through the Sino-British Joint Declaration.
Australia is treading a fine line in the trade war between its largest trading partner, China, and its most significant security partner, the United States. And Scott Morrison says he doesn't think there will be a resolution anytime soon.
Look, I don't think it's going to happen quick.
It's a different position to what Mr. Morrison has previously stated.
I was more confident going into the G20 meeting in Argentina and Buenos Aires, and they did make quite a bit of progress there, but things really fell back after that. I think we're going to have to get used to this for a while, this level of tension. Okay.
So just how long will this trade war go for? Peter Jennings agrees that a resolution is not around the corner.
But I don't know that Donald Trump thinks that it's in his interests to resolve this dispute. at least up until the next presidential election in the US. So maybe that what we're going to see is perhaps another 18 months at least of US-China trade disputes. And that's something that's going to be, you know, potentially very difficult for Australia to navigate.
Peter Jennings from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute there, Stephanie Boris with that report. Joining me now in the World Today studio is the ABC Senior Business Correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, we've just been hearing the Prime Minister voice his concerns that the US-China trade war is not likely to end soon. We've also heard from Peter Jennings there. Which parts of Australia's economy are most exposed?
Well, Eleanor, that continuing uncertainty, especially if trade tensions explode into being a trade war, would undoubtedly hurt Australia's trade relationship with China and hurt most sectors of the economy. But perhaps take a bit of a glass half full. There's already good demand for Australian beef, wheat and wine. That's growing. Agricultural exports are currently sitting at around $12 billion a year. And even if things do turn worse, that would lower the Australian dollar, which last week hit a 10-year low. And of course, a lower currency is better news for Australian exporters. And if China needs to step in and stimulate its economy in a downturn, that would require more iron ore to make steel, which of course is Australia's biggest export. Now, BHP is the biggest player here with its exports of iron ore to China. BHP's chief executive, Andrew McKenzie, says the US-China trade war isn't hurting demand for its commodities just yet. And BHP's full-year profit of $8.3 billion in the full year, that's more than double than last year's result, is evidence that higher iron ore price represent almost half of BHP's bottom line. And Andrew McKenzie says China's demand for especially high-quality iron ore from Australia is key here, but he warns the escalating tensions driven by nationalism in some parts could put those fortunes at risk.
We continue to, I think, enjoy strong sales to China, but there is no doubt that while this continues, it is actually putting a bit of a dampener on world economic growth and certainly the prospects for world economic growth that ultimately, if not yet, will impact the demand for our products. More generally, I would say that we do feel there is a number of things abroad right now where, you know, increased nationalism in global trade flows and global supply chains, and indeed just the good business of capitalism and free enterprise and free competition, it is a consideration.
So that's the BHP Chief Executive, Andrew McKenzie. And Peter, also making news today is the future of Seven West Media, which owns the Seven Television Network. What's the latest there?
Well, many analysts saw this coming, but this morning Seven posted a full-year loss of $444.5 million. This just a few days after Chief Executive Tim Warner resigned and was replaced by the former Ten Network boss, James Warburton. Now, much of this is due to big write-downs in the value of Seven's TV licence and also newspaper mastheads as digital disruption continues to cut a swathe through traditional free-to-air TV, which was once described as a money-printing machine, no longer. James Warburton wants to speed up the pace of transformation. He concedes that Seven, while being a ratings leader, has some tired formats, and he says Seven needs to be a hunter and an explorer. But Mr. Warburton thinks it is possible to take on Facebook and Google, and he didn't rule out a merger further down the track with a bigger player, for example, like News Corporation.
The strength of the digital and promotional area is extraordinary. Gives us a huge shot to really take on Google and Facebook in the addressable advertising area. You don't flick a switch. It's not going to happen, you know, in 5 minutes flat. It's a very specific and intelligent, you know, sort of push towards improving our content and monetizing it and transforming the company and looking at where we need to be.
So given your comments about tired formats, is Seven interested in any potential mergers or acquisitions with big players, for example, like a News Corporation?
Look, I think, as I said, I've been, you know, pretty transparent in terms of the fact that we have a desire, you know, as does the board, to transform the company, and nothing's on or off the table, but the point of focus is transforming the company.
That's Seven West Media Chief Executive James Warburton with the ABC's Peter Ryan. An international survey of state surveillance has ranked two Australian cities as some of the most tightly watched in the world, with Sydney coming in ahead of Moscow and Baghdad. It's alarmed privacy experts who warn that it's yet more evidence of overzealous collection of our personal data. So why are Australian authorities watching us so closely? Julia Holman has our report.
If you're in Australia's biggest city, Sydney, chances are at some point in your day, a CCTV camera is watching you.
Public space, private space, on public transport. Some of the systems are deliberately designed to be visible. Others are deliberately concealed so that you can't tell that they're there. So it could be just about anywhere.
That's David Vail, who's the chairman of the Australian Privacy Foundation. He says there's no way of knowing exactly how many cameras are out there.
Some of them run by the government, some of them run by individuals, some of them run by companies or councils. Since the government removed the coverage of privacy law from council use of CCTV in 2012, after they lost a case, it's just proliferated out of hand.
A report by Comparatech, a UK-based firm, ranked 120 cities based on the number of public CCTV cameras per 1,000 people. It found that Sydney is 15th, with an estimated 60,000 public CCTV cameras, or 12 for every 1,000 of us. Ahead of Sydney on the list are 9 Chinese cities: London, Atlanta, Chicago, Singapore, and Abu Dhabi. Some cities that are further down the list include Moscow, Baghdad, New York, and Washington, D.C.
I think it's probably a surprising outcome to many Australians. It doesn't surprise me.
Dr. Soulette Dreyfus is from the University of Melbourne.
There has been surveillance creep that has occurred very much over the last couple of years, and that includes the creep that comes from cameras being installed.
Soulette, you're in Melbourne, which according to this report is ranked pretty far down on the list, 117th in the world. Why is there such a difference between Australia's two biggest cities when we come to CCTV?
Well, one of two options. Either Melbourne is far better surveyed than the authors of the report understood, and that hasn't been included. I suspect there's a little bit of that actually going on, and it's sometimes hard to get this information, so not surprising. But also, I suspect that Sydney has been a greater focal point, perhaps for the political climate. Certainly, law enforcement has had a very high visibility in New South Wales, and that could be one of the reasons why.
What is this information that's gathered actually used for?
Well, that's a very good question. So in some cases, it would be used just to protect private property if you're running a camera outside of your business. But in other cases, it might be used for stopping crime. Unfortunately, it can also be used as a tool of oppression.
Dr. Dreyfus worries that the data collected may not always be used for its intended purpose and believes there's inadequate rules governing the use of CCTV footage and facial recognition.
There's basically a bleed of how widespread the use of that data becomes. So it starts out for one thing and turns into another.
But Dr. Michael Kennedy, a senior lecturer in criminology and policing at the University of Western Sydney, dismisses the concerns.
You can't just count the number of cameras and use that as an indicator of surveillance that's taking place. I think it's part of a moral panic. Oh, beware, there's everybody, Big Brother's on the march. Most of the cameras that are installed by the state are about traffic regulation and train regulation and that sort of thing.
The Comparatech report estimated the number of CCTV cameras for some cities because that information isn't publicly available. Dr. Kennedy says that's a major credibility flaw.
If you're going to be using numbers on its own, the numbers have got to be accurate and they've got to withstand scrutiny. And if they can't, then the report is just not worth the paper it's written on.
The World Today requested an interview with the Comparatech author who wrote the report, as well as the New South Wales Police Minister David Elliott. Both were unavailable for comment.
Julia Holman reporting. This is The World Today, and if you're just joining us, you can find all our stories on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to The World Today wherever you get your podcasts. The Australian government's policy of locating asylum seekers in offshore detention centres in Papua New Guinea has been under question since a PNG Supreme Court case in 2016 found the detention illegal. Now the government of Papua New Guinea is offering refugees still on Manus Island a voluntary transfer to the nation's capital, Port Moresby. With more, I'm joined by political reporter Alexandra Beach. Alex, firstly, what exactly is the PNG government offering to these refugees?
Eleanor, the information provided to the refugees shows that they are being offered that opportunity to move from Manus to Port Moresby. And this is for a group of men that's been on Manus for about 6 years and they've been found to be genuine refugees. They have been reassured as part of this that they're not going to be put in immigration detention, but that in Port Moresby they'd be provided with self-contained accommodation, a weekly allowance, healthcare services, education and training. So this is not a permanent solution, but they have also been told that if they are already part of the group that's being considered for resettlement in the United States, that moving to Port Moresby as part of this won't affect that process. And if they've been denied by the United States, that this will give them basically a place to stay while they consider their options for the future.
We've seen some of these stranded refugees being privately funded by concerned Australians to resettle in Canada. How are the refugees themselves that are being offered this Port Moresby option responding?
Well, it is still early days for reaction off Manus, but there has been a little bit of talk on social media. So writer and Manus Island detainee Behrouz Bashani has posted on Twitter that Port Moresby is the same as Manus and that they can't live in Papua New Guinea. He's also shared a comment by another man who says they've already been transferred from country to country and that they're sick of political games. But I spoke with Graham Tom, the refugee advisor for Amnesty International, and he was cautiously optimistic. He says that it looks like this could signal the beginning of the end for offshore processing on Manus Island, which he sees as a positive. But he also remains worried as well that this isn't a long-term solution for this group of about 130 men and argues it's really time to talk about New Zealand's offer to take people. Here's a bit of what he had to say about this offer.
It is a significant step. However, we still have serious concerns about their physical safety and also about their health care and the fact that this does not provide them with a durable solution. You know, this is just another move for these guys after 6 years.
What would you like to see happen next?
Well, it's time that durable solutions were found for all these men. We need to make sure, firstly, if they are moved to Port Moresby, that their safety is paramount, because this is one of the most dangerous cities in the world and these men are going to stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, when we've been to Port Moresby to visit men taken there for medical treatment, they've described how they've been attacked and just how scared they are, really.
So that's Graham Tom from Amnesty International. Alex, has there been any reaction yet from the Australian government?
Yes, in a statement, the government says Australia is aware that this is happening, but also it says PNG is acting under its own domestic legislation here and that it's acting within its own sovereign right.
Alexandra Beach in Canberra, thank you. Australia's eastern coastline is set to get a battering over the next few days as stormy conditions create powerful ocean swells. And climate scientists say we need to brace for more frequent events like this. Research published in Nature Climate Change predicts that half of the world's coastlines will see increased wave damage if global temperatures rise by more than 1.5 degrees. Isabel Rowe has more.
The swell is already picking up on Sydney's eastern beaches as a low pressure system in the Tasman Sea moves closer to the coast.
It is going to be windy though, and that's going to slowly move up the coast over the next couple of days.
And so the warning's in place today?
Yeah, for both the north and the south.
Keen surfers and ocean swimmers have been warned.
6 metres on the Bureau's forecast I saw last night, so that's a huge sea state generated by a very intense low-pressure system.
University of New South Wales Professor Matthew England is both an ocean swimmer and an oceanographer.
We're expecting under global warming for these storm systems to become more intense, so we're expecting to see more of these very intense low-pressure systems that generate huge sea states.
The impending weather makes research published today in the journal Nature Climate Change particularly timely. The research has found that if the planet's temperature trajectory continues, by the end of the 21st century, waves will be bigger and start crashing to shore in slightly different directions. Griffith University PhD researcher Joao Mori is the paper's lead author.
Those are likely to have a significant impact on the coastlines we see today, the shape of the coastlines.
The paper compares the impact of a 1.5 degree temperature rise with a 2 degree rise. Joao Mori says the difference is significant.
If we keep warming to 2 degrees, we will see this change happening. If we limit warming below 1.5 degrees, changes become much less severe and we cannot distinguish them from the natural variability, which means the natural state of the climate.
The power of larger-than-usual waves is already evident. Professor Matthew England remembers the damage caused to the New South Wales coast by 3-metre swells 3 years ago.
A lot of our infrastructure, a lot of our buildings, a lot of people want to live by the sea. You know, we're seeing that infrastructure getting hit by big storms and massive damage. I noticed the walkway near Bronte Beach there was closed for a couple of years. It got smashed by a storm and it took such a long time to repair.
Joao Mori says scientists have long warned of the effect of climate change on sea levels, but he explains staying in control of wave heights is an additional challenge.
What this shows is, together with sea level rise alone is only half the story, and if we only adapting to sea level rise, we might have very costly maladaptation measures.
The Paris Climate Agreement's long-term goal is to keep warming to 1.5 degrees.
Isabel Rowe reporting. Could a party drug that's been linked to several deaths at Australian music festivals now be used to help alcoholics struggling with addiction? Well, that's one of the findings from a study into the use of MDMA, or ecstasy, by doctors from the Imperial College in London. They led a trial which found using small doses of MDMA is safe and more effective than other treatments. So how does it work? Amelia Turzon has been investigating.
Gold Coast man David Scott was drinking a six-pack a day when he realised that he had a problem.
I tried to cut back and I couldn't. I had to go through the bottle every afternoon. I had to have alcohol every afternoon.
Then his wife gave him an ultimatum.
Quite frankly, she just said she couldn't live with me anymore.
10 years after walking into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, he's still sober and has never relapsed. But David Scott has seen many others who are less fortunate.
Well, I've had a couple of close friends who have relapsed, but, they've come back.
Alcoholics Anonymous Australia doesn't take statistics on how many of its members relapse. But now researchers are suggesting a different way to help alcoholics via the party drug ecstasy, also known as MDMA. Professor of Neuropsychopharmacology at the Imperial College London, David Nutt, helped run the trial. He told the BBC that the illegal drug has therapeutic benefits.
Using MDMA in a therapeutic setting, so the actual day, the day they get the treatment, so they get two of these 2 weeks apart, they have about 6 or 7 hours of therapy. So they're working through the traumas of their life, trying to make sense of why they're drinking, what are they trying to forget, what are the issues which have damaged them.
11 people took part in the study, but so far only one has completely relapsed. That compares to the study author's claim that 80% relapse within 3 years by using traditional methods.
So it was a small study. It was designed just to see whether it was safe to give MDMA to people with the medical problems that accompany alcoholism. But also, for most of them, it was actually beneficial in that they managed to significantly cut down their drinking for weeks and months afterwards.
It's not the first study that's looked into whether the party drug, which gives people euphoria but also comes with a risk of overdose, has therapeutic benefits. The drug has been extensively studied in relation to post-traumatic stress disorder, depression and anxiety. And it's not just MDMA that's being investigated by psychiatrists. Another party drug, ketamine, is being researched for depression. And in Melbourne, a trial at St Vincent's Hospital has been given the go-ahead to use active ingredients in magic mushrooms to treat patients suffering from depression. Dr Stephen Bright is a psychologist and a lecturer in addiction at Edith Cowan University. He welcomes the trend.
Look, I think there's a big difference between the recreational use of
psychedelic drugs and the use of these drugs in a clinical environment, there is plenty of evidence worldwide now from international psychedelic science renaissance showing that these drugs are effective in treating a range of conditions.
Alcoholics Anonymous David Scott says that everybody battles their addictions differently, but that his organisation would never condone the use of illegal drugs to help its members.
No, we would never consider that. We just advocate abstinence, and that's AA in good stead for over 80 years now.
The study's researchers are warning people not to try to replicate their study at home.
Amelia Turzon reporting. And that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
I'm Ruby Jones.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
So we now have a bit of an idea about the unethical things that have been happening in our financial system.
Things like fees for no service, dead people being charged for financial advice, you name it, the banks were called out on it at the Royal Commission.
And now the government says it's going to implement some recommendations and the industry's on notice.
Now, they're tough words, but when it comes to one of the most powerful sectors of the Australian economy, what do they actually mean, and will they make any difference?
That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.